Good evening. My name is Seda. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is August 1st of 2003. And I have a sponsor, and my home group is the Midtown Group. And so I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I guess to get started, I feel like when I was growing up, I mean, when I look back at my life, I feel like I've had almost like three lifetimes in one, because there was my life before I was drinking, there was my life when I found alcohol, and then there's been my life since I've been sober. And I'm a little nervous, sorry. So let me just take a minute. Okay, so, you know, I feel like I was destined for self-centeredness as a child. I was an only child, and I grew up in my parents did everything they could to, to give me what they could. And I never really, I had everything I needed. And that was, that was a great blessing. And I know that from the start, I think I always felt a separation from other people. I remember when I'd go see my family in West Virginia, I felt like I was somehow different because I didn't live down there. And, you know, and that's sort of how it started for me. I felt like there was always, like a big piece of plexiglass between me and, like, the other human beings walking around. And supposedly, I'm not quite sure about this, but my mom said that everything was great until about kindergarten. And that's when there started to be the reports of antisocial behavior and just wanting to hang out with the grown-ups and not really playing well with others. So, you know, I believe this is I know inside that it's a spiritual malady, and I think I had that before I took a drink, but definitely alcohol changed me on the inside, and I found the solution to what I thought was how to live my life. I was attracted to alcohol from a young age. My parents would have, like, you know, little house parties, and people would come over, and I always knew that I couldn't wait till I could grow up and drink, you know. And me and my cousin, we used to, my dad had this little thing called a barbell, and it was just a piece of, like, wood with a bell on it, and it said, ring for another round. And so we'd ring the bell, and we would make these concoctions of orange juice and seltzer water so we could learn how to drink when we got old enough to do it. So I think, you know, I had an unnatural attraction to alcohol from the beginning. And you know, by the time I was starting off in sixth grade, I felt like, I can't believe there's six more years of this school stuff. I couldn't seem to get through life very well. So I had my first drink, my actual first drink of alcohol, when I was 15 years old. I was a freshman in high school, and me and my best friend at the time, we had skipped school that day after lunch, and we walked to my house, and we split one bottle of Bartles and James wine cooler. We stole it from the fridge, and you know, I drank half of it, she drank the other half. And I was waiting. I mean, I was, like, waiting with anticipation for, like, some type of effect, because I knew there was supposed to be something about this. And to my surprise, nothing happened. I mean, I got a thrill out of doing something I knew I wasn't supposed to be doing, but I didn't get a buzz or anything. And so I quickly, I'm sneaky. I did what I always do. I hid the evidence in a boot in the closet. And about a year later, that same friend was over at my house, and it snowed, and my mom found the boot. She was looking for the boot to give to my friend to wear home, and there's this bottle stuck in it, and she had a, you know, heart attack, basically. And, you know, as I'm sure I would if I found that in my house, too, but, you know, that was the only drink I'd ever had, and she basically scared me into acting straight for a long while. And I mean, I didn't touch alcohol for the rest of my high school years, but I ended up failing out of school. I was kicked out of my high school completely dry. You know, I didn't have a way of living that could get, you know, that I could actually live with. So I was making a lot of trouble just without even drinking. And soon after I graduated from adult education, I wasn't much to be proud of about that. But, you know, I quickly started, I started going to community college, and I, you know, I thought I'd found a career I wanted to do. I wanted to be a nurse, so I started taking the classes to attain that goal, and I started working part-time on the weekends, and I started waiting tables. And, you know, I would drive by this one restaurant, and it always had a sign in the window that said, waitress needed. And it was this, I mean, this was sort of like the, this is where my drinking sort of started, I mean, I started to be attracted towards, like, I just wanted to be bad. I don't have another way to say it. I knew that I belonged on, like, the, you know, the dark end of the street or something. And you know, I kept driving by this little, like, you know, dingy bar and thinking, that's where I need to be. And I finally went in and applied, and I got the job. And so I was working at this place called Whitey's. And my first night there, I just remember I was running around like a chicken with my head cut off, and they told me to clean the pool rails around, and this kind of place, you know, I'm stacking the glasses, and there's a glass that's like half full of vomit, you know. I mean, that's the sort of place, and that was my first night, and I was like, okay, I can deal with that, you know. I mean, not a big deal, And so I started working there, and I still hadn't started to drink, but I'm surrounded by people that are definitely getting effect from alcohol, and I really liked the people I worked with. They were, like, kind of had a hard edge to them, had lived a hard life, and they drank a lot, and it looked attractive. I mean, it just looked like what I wanted to do. And so I guess probably a couple months into working that job, my father died suddenly. It was, you know, it sort of rocked my world. And I think whatever I had been holding on to try to, like, well, I guess whatever. I mean, I loved my dad so much. Well, I still love him a lot. But whatever I've been holding on to try to do the right thing or make something good of my life, I just kind of let go. And, you know, I was still in school. I just got into nursing school in Roanoke, Virginia. And I sort of just decided, you know, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. And I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to cuss up here, but, you know, kind of like F the world, you know. And, and right around that time, you know, it's lovely how people get put in your life. I found the one, you know, I found the guy, and it was like a restaurant romance, you know, and he was a bouncer, and I'm a waitress, and, you know, he had trouble written all over him, and I just sort of chased him down, and I was, you're going to love me, you know, and he was a big part of my drinking, because that's where I learned how to drink how I drank. You know, I started running around with this guy in the summer of 98, and I remember the first night I got drunk. I mean, I remember it like I can see it in my mind. I was at the bar I worked at, and they had live music there, and you know, I went through a bunch of phases with my alcohol, like trying different brands. But I think I started with like Southern Comfort and ginger ale, and I would just, you know, I just remember like getting that euphoric feeling and feeling like I felt like someone had just given me the book on life. Like, this is how people get through. If you do this every day, nothing's going to bother you, you know. And I made the conscious decision to drink every time I had the chance, you know, and I was almost 21, and you know, so I had a lot of fun. I mean, my first, I don't know, 3 months of drinking were like no problems. I mean, I ran around that summer and chasing this guy and drinking and having a really good time. I felt like I finally knew, I felt like I finally felt how other people seemed to be, and I felt like it gave me, like, I felt like I was a part of the world for the first time. And so that was, you know, and that's what alcohol does for me. It removes that huge hole I have on the inside, and I feel like I can look you in the eye and, you know, and be a part of this thing called life. And that little euphoric, lovely phase of my drinking was not really that long of a period. I drank for a total of 3 years, about, and you know, within the first 6 months of my drinking, I went away to that school, and I tried to control my drinking as I was going through nursing school, and I just, you know, drinking was much more important than school for me, and I would do the 3.5-hour drive home every weekend to party with my friends, and you know, I always loved having a story. I don't know what that's all about, but even if I didn't remember what happened, if someone could tell me what happened and then I could repeat it, and it was kind of funny, or at least funny to me, you know, I just felt like I was building this you know, this like lovely collection of things I could tell my kids or something. I don't know, but I loved having good stories, and so by the time December rolled around, and I had a few altercations with the resident staff at the college because I was doing things that, you know, I was drinking on campus and other outside issues at school, and they kind of caught wind of that. So I was sort of on my, I was like, you know, they were getting ready to kick me out, and I said, well, I'm leaving anyway, you know, and I sort of ran back to D.C. with my you know, tail between my legs, and I remember sitting down with my mom, and I told her, I was like, you know, I just want to be a working girl, you know, I don't think I'm cut out for this school thing, and so, you know, and my mom, I mean, she was, you know, she was begging for me to do the right thing, and I was just, you know, I just wanted to work at Whitey's and drink how I wanted to drink, and my mom was not, I did that for a couple months, and she got a little unhappy with those actions, because I started, you know, coming home really late at night, and this one night, I remember, I came home, and I passed out, and about, like, 6:30 in the morning, my mom woke me up, and she's yelling about, and I'm kind of trying to figure out what she's yelling about, but I guess I had gotten sick on the way out of the car, because I was riding in a van, and I was just laying in the back of the van, and we're going around turns and stuff, and so I get out, and I immediately throw up in the yard, and then my mom's yelling at me at 6 in the morning because there's crows in the yard, and she's like, who vomited in the driveway? And I'm like, oh, that was me, and she, you know, she's like, oh, that's just, you know, I really didn't, I didn't make a good impression with the neighbors, basically, and I mean, that's the sort of stuff that were starting to happen, and my mom thought if she could just get me away from those people, get me away from that guy, that I would straighten up. And so I moved out to Denver, Colorado, and because I had a friend from high school who moved there. And you know, if there was any question in my mind that I wasn't an alcoholic up to that point, there were things that happened in Denver that I'm aware of looking back that that definitely, you know, it sounds like the part in the big book about more about alcoholism, you know. I got out there, I was living with my one friend, and you know, and she wasn't really into partying 5 nights a week and staying in 2 nights a week, and I started you know, the delusions started to set in. I had started, I would call people on the phone, and then I would go shot for shot with people on the phone in Virginia, because somewhere I knew that you weren't supposed to drink alone. I mean, I just knew that drinking alone that was wrong. And so I would call these people and I would drink on the phone with them, because then that's not technically drinking alone. And, you know, if I stayed up all night and it's 8:30 in the morning and I'm still drinking, because I did not go to sleep, that's not technically drinking in the morning. It's still, you know, the day before for me. And those delusions started to set in, and I tried switching my brand so many times. I mean, it went from everything from the Southern Comfort in the beginning to, you know, vodka, and I never really liked beer. It took too much to try to get drunk on beer, but You know, I went through my Jim Beam phase, my tequila phase, you know, and I would just start switching back and forth because I had, you know, I couldn't control the amount I took. And then I did really, you know, tragic, you know, things when I was drunk and I couldn't remember what I did and, you know, which in time led to the incomprehensible demoralization. And so I, you know, started drinking in Denver, drinking by myself, drinking in the morning. I quit my job without getting another job, and so my mom's like paying for me basically to stay out there and sit at home and drink. And I had the alcoholic loneliness. I mean, like the one friend that I had, she basically took off to her boyfriend's house, and you know, it was just me and the bottle. And I decided to just take a Greyhound bus home. One weekend, I just made the decision that it's time to leave. And so I came back to Arlington and worked at the same bar and did the same things. And you know, and my mom was, I put her through so much during that time of my life. At one point, you know, she wanted me to leave. You know, she didn't want me to live in her house and drink the way that I did. So I chose to live with this guy, the same guy from the, you know, the first summer that I started drinking. And we were basically, you know, we're living in a crack house in Arlington, Virginia. And then, you know, we got kicked out of there because, you know, they actually want you to pay your bills there, too, if you have rent due. They want their rent due. And so, instead of, you know, going back to my mom's, which that was an option if I wanted to not drink the way I did, I decided to be homeless and live in I was living in an office building. They would rent band practice spaces in the basement and in the, like, attic of the building. And so I'm living in the attic of this office building with this guy and his new girlfriend, and I'm somewhere between homicidal and suicidal, and you know, I'm breaking in my mom's house every other day. I would steal the change from the jar in the kitchen, and take showers so I could, you know, I would buy 40 ounces of beer with the change I would steal from my mom, and I was living off of those green granola bars and peanut butter that, you know, I'd never want to eat another green granola bar, I'll tell you that. And it was a really good day if we got to eat pasta with Parmesan cheese on it. You know, I mean, that was like, that's how I chose to live rather than try to control my drinking. And you know, I guess, to make it brief, by the time 2000 rolled around, 2001, I would have these moments of kind of pulling everything together, and I'd start working at a different restaurant, and I would, you know, try to do the right thing and try to take a class, and then I'd drop out of the class, the consequences and the, you know, I basically sold every moral fiber that I had for a drink. I mean, I gave it away so I could drink. And I guess, like, it's really vivid in my mind. I know that at one point I was living in D.C. in this, it was actually a really, I think it's a better neighborhood now, but it's over in Northwest. And I would usually wake up every morning. This would be like the normal day that I would wake up to. I would be hungover from the night before, and I would usually be almost late to work, and I would be lucky if I had $5 in my pocket to either catch a cab to work or grab a pack of cigarettes, and I would be waiting tables and between waiting tables thrown up in the bathroom, and I would be thinking to myself the whole morning, like, okay, this is, you know, I need to rest, I need to stay in the night, I'm, you know, look at me, you know, and usually around 2 in the afternoon, I would finally be able to keep some food down, and I would have a little bit of money in my pocket from the lunchtime business, and the people that I worked with, we would always leave work during the break and go drink, and then come back to work for the dinner shift. And at that point, I would always be like, well, one's not such a bad idea, you know, and I can go do this. And then I would be waiting tables drunk in the evening, and then it would just repeat itself, and I would wake up the next morning hungover. And I couldn't break that cycle. I couldn't do the right thing. I mean, I tried many times to pull it together, and you know, I basically, in the fall, I mean, in the March of 2001, I was working at a restaurant, and I was doing the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift, and I was going home from work. I had borrowed my friend's car because I had so many parking tickets on my car that I was afraid they were going to boot me in the city. So I begged my my best friend from high school. I was like, please, just let me, you know, let me take your car. You can have mine. It'll be fine. I'll be back in the morning. It's not. Nothing's going to happen, you know. And as I'm driving home that night or that morning, I was on Rock Creek Parkway, which it's by a creek with a lot of rocks, and I was going to the first turn, and I just decided to take a nap, and so I fell asleep behind the wheel, and I woke up when I went off the road, and I was kind of off-roading in the grass, and I hit a tree at 40 miles an hour without my seatbelt on, and her car was just in pieces, and these people were walking their dog that morning, and they're like, we called the ambulance, you know, and I just, I don't know if I was in shock, but I was like, oh, I'm fine. I think I can drive it home. And there was like pieces of the tree sticking in the tires. So I was just, they're like, you're bleeding. I'm like, oh, that's not a problem, you know. And that was sort of when I started looking for another answer besides the ones that I had come up with on my own. Because every way I could try to think of to stop drinking didn't work. I mean, I couldn't go more than, I think I went 2 or 3 days without drinking. And it just, I never had the physical, like the DTs or anything like that. But I mean, I just might, you know, I just couldn't stay away. I couldn't put it away. And so, and after that car accident, I really made an effort to control and enjoy my drinking. I mean, I put all of my effort into it, to stay away from those other things and to not pick up the drink. And I've made a phone call that probably saved my life. It was to one of my friends that I used to party with, and I knew that she was in a methadone treatment clinic and that she would maybe know where I could get some help, you know. And so I called her, and she gave me the number for the Arlington County drug and alcohol abuse. And this poor woman that got to talk to me that morning, I mean, I was drinking, I was doing other things, and she got me on the phone, but it was the first time I was completely honest with anybody about how I was living. And you know, and I was kind of hysterical, and I'm, you know, putting the phone down so I can drink some more as I'm talking to her. And she said, I think you need to go to detox. And I thought, well, that's a little rash. I mean, you know, like, you want me to go to, you know, how long is that? And they're like, oh, at the most it's 2 weeks. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so I spin this story for my mom that I'm depressed, and I'm going to get help through the county for the depression, but, you know, they first want to see how I am without alcohol, you know, because I drink a lot. And my mom was like, whatever. I mean, at this point, she just wanted something to happen. And so during that, like, two-week period of me trying to control my drinking, I ended up drinking a liter of vodka, making some phone calls, trying to get some other things to help me drink longer, and ended up driving in a blackout with the cast on from the last car accident. So, and that scared me. I mean, because I realized that even with all the knowledge of what was going on, I couldn't stop. So I went to that detox, and my mom dropped me off, and I remember walking in, and she was behind me, and I had been drinking the night before, and I was not the most pleasant person to be around, and And so they make you blow into the breathalyzer, and I'm blowing into this thing, and my mom's like hovering over my shoulder, and I just wanted to be like, these are my numbers, like, get away from me, you know? And which I actually did. I got a 0.0, so that's the only time I've ever been breathalyzed. But so I went in and I immediately saw the people there, and I thought, there's no way this is for me, you know, there's no way. And I mean, I feel like from the, you know, I can look back and see how even before I even thought there was a God that was, you know, going to help me, that God was helping me the whole time, you know. So, anyway, thankfully I was quite paranoid, and I thought that people were talking about me, and that if I didn't do what they told me to do, they were going to call the cops. I mean, this is what I thought going in there. I didn't know that they couldn't do that. But so when they told me to stay for 25 days in detox and then go to the 90-day rehab treatment program, I thought, I better do it or they're going to send them, you know, send the cops on me. So I said I would do that. And I was starting to, you know, actually... the fog was lifting a little bit, and I knew that, like, I was in a mess. I knew that there was, that there wasn't a lot of options left, and so I stayed in that program, and thankfully, I mean, the one thing that I got from the place that I went to, it wasn't one of those really nice rehabs where, you know, you have pools, and, I mean, it was for people that had no money, and you know, they took us to meetings. They brought meetings into that facility, and I mean, I just I sort of fell in love with the people in AA. Maybe not so much the program, but I really related to other people that had the same problem that I had, and I believed their stories. I believed that they came from where I was from and that they were able to get better. And you know, I knew all of this. I got out of rehab. I got a job working in a bookstore, and I got a sponsor, and I started going to the home group I'm at today. And you know, I want to tell you that, you know, everything was great after that. But you know, my disease, my illness is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and I found other ways to try to change my mood, is basically what it came down to. And so I feel like it took me about 2.5 years to get a first step. I was in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to work the steps. I mean, I did a fourth and a fifth step, and I was, you know, I wasn't sober. And so, I mean, I found out later on that, you know, the steps really work if you have a sobriety date, you know, and that's my own experience. And but, you know, I wasn't convinced that I really needed to do everything that everyone else had to do here. I mean, I looked at the eighth and ninth step and I felt like, no way, no way, because I am a thief. I mean, I stole, we're talking probably close to $30,000 from one of my employers, you know, because I worked there for 3 years and I knew the void code, you know what I mean? And I would, I just stole what I could, and I would steal people's credit cards, and I looked at the eighth and ninth step and I was like, there's no way I'm doing that. And I mean, I was so resentful at, like, my family and other people in my life that I really didn't think that there was, I didn't think that my heart could soften or that my resentment would leave. And so I kept changing my mood in silence, basically. And so, basically, I was miserable in AA for 2.5 years. There's nothing worse than, you know, being around sober, happy people and pretending you're one of those sober, happy people when you're not. And everyone, I mean, I feel like if I saw me back then, I would know that there was something wrong. You know, there was definitely something wrong. But I feel that, you know, when I think about the steps, like 1, 2, and 3, I feel like those sort of, you know, I feel like they happened to me kind of at one, you know, at one time, because, you know, at some point in July of 2003, I was separated from alcohol for the last time, And I didn't make it happen. I didn't make a decision to make it happen. I believe that, you know, the grace of God came in my life and did what I couldn't do. So I should have warned you all that I'm a crier. My sponsor likes to say that if I'm telling the truth, I'm usually crying. So that's a good sign. But, you know, and so basically, you know, I feel like 1, 2, and 3 happened sometime in July of 2003 for me, because I had seen what AA could do for other people. There was a moment of clarity again. You know, I had many moments of clarity, but something actually changed this time, and I became willing to do whatever AA asked me to do. And within a month of my sobriety date, I did an honest fourth and fifth step, and you know, I did whatever people asked me to do in AA. And I think I started sponsoring a woman probably in October of that year. And it was amazing. I mean, I felt like I was seeing life in color, finally, you know. I don't want to just talk about the material things, because that's not really what happened. I feel like there's been a lot of things that have changed internally that I can't really put to words. I know that working the steps has changed me. And I feel like, you know, some of them, it just doesn't seem like it's ever going to be over, like 6 and 7. I mean, it's like any time I think I've gotten some type of, I've got that done, you know, there's always something more to be done with those steps, because I'm selfish to the core. I believe that, you know, it's been reduced, you know, and that I have changed in that way, but I still think about myself, you know, all the time. And you know, it's like, it's one of those things. It's one of the, you know, this is the root of my problem, and it takes many forms. And it's usually, you know, what do you think of me? How do I look? And am I going to get what I want? You know? So, but I did, you know, I did an eighth and a ninth step when I was, or I did my eighth step when I was about 18 months sober. And, you know, I feel like that, the eighth step really, you know, I know that people get, like, they get a clear picture of themselves in the fourth step and a fifth step when they talk to their sponsor. I feel like mine came in the eighth step, because it wasn't anything about what I thought others had done to me. It was a look of exactly what I did to other people. And, you know, I was not a nice girl that drank too much, that's for sure. I mean, I said I desperately wanted to be, like, you know, itching for the bad side, for being in trouble, and I was, you know. I mean, I was there. And you know, I just I've been able to make amends to... I've been working on the ninth step for a while, and a lot of my ninth step amends are financial, and I believe through the grace of God in this program, I've been able to get through. I actually got to go back to nursing school. I got a great opportunity to fill a dream in AA, you know, which will also fill my financial requirements to make amends. So, I mean, I feel like once I was willing to give that money back, that I was able to, you know, start doing the education to get a career that would make that happen. And there's a lot of, not to be morbid, but a lot of my amends have been, like, graveside amends, or, you know, I mean, a lot of people that I hurt had passed away before I got there, before I got to AA, or before I got to the step. And you know, I've had really great experiences with that. I mean, when I was, my dad died in 1997, and in 2007, my mom and I, me and my mom and her sister, we spread his ashes, you know, because my mom couldn't let go for a long time. And just the fact that I could be there and, you know, be present for my mom and, like, not just be shut off and numb and, you know, it was amazing, you know, and I don't feel the same way that I did 10 years ago about that. I mean, something's changed. And I had a really, my grandmother on my mom's side of the family. She was great. I mean, she loved me more than she should have, you know? And when I was little, I remember, like, being, like, 12 years old, and we used to, when I would go stay with her, we would sleep in the same bed, and all she wanted to do was, like, you know, snuggle up, and, you know, and I just, at that point, I just remember, I fell out of the bed, because I was just trying to get away. I mean, I just wanted to get away, and, you know, and I just, you know, Nana, give me my space, you know, and when, I guess when I was 20, she had Alzheimer's, you know. And it went pretty fast, and by the time I was 24, I mean, I was in AA, not sober, but I was in AA, and my mom was going to go see her for basically the last time, and my opinion of that was, well, she hasn't known who I am for 3 years, you know, and I'm thinking to myself now, it's like, I'm in a spiritual program, and I don't understand that the spirit knows, you know, so, and that's, you know, that's a mistake I get to live with. But so my grandmother passed away. I was, you know, I went to the funeral, and then I got to my 8-step a couple years later. And so, you know, I went to my my family's from West Virginia. I went down there and I made amends to two of my uncles, and one of them drove me to the family graveside, and it was like April, and I thought it would just be, you know, like April how it is up here in Virginia, but there's still snow and stuff, and so I had to walk up this big hill to get to the knoll where the graveside was, and that's where we had spread her ashes. And so I have my little letter, you know, and I'm trudging up the hill, and I get to the top, and it's like all, you know, it's all nice and warm up there with the sun, and so, and the, it's really windy, so I'm like holding the letter at one end and at the other, and I'm reading, and I guess you can guess I'm probably crying, you know, I'm just crying. And after, you know, after I finished reading, it just stopped, you know, the wind stopped. And so I just stood up there. You know, and I felt like she was there. I felt like God was there. So, that was by far the first time I ever felt the presence of God in my life, you know? And I walked off that knoll like a freer person. So, you know, and I mean, not all of them have gone that way. I mean, I made amends to a girl in high school that, you know, that the best that could have happened is that I made my side of the street clean, and I didn't try to hurt her anymore in the making of that amends, you know, and she has never called me back. So, you know, some go really well, and some is just, it's the right thing to do, and it's the thing that I need to do to stay sober. But there, you know, there's always more to be done with that. I feel like, you know, my 9-step, the longer I stay sober, the more I remember. You know, and it's not just all about the money or the lying. I mean, a lot of it's just, you know, the way I can treat people in my life, you know, because I just go through, sometimes I just go through life and I'm the tornado, you know, and it's not like I just, when they talk about ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing, it's like, isn't it grand that I'm not drinking today, you know, aren't you so happy about that? And I can be such a taker, even sober, and so I just say, I know there's always more to be done, and more I can try to give back to other people. So, you know, and my other grandmother, she passed away when I was 2 years sober, and I got to make amends to her. I mean, it was, you know, she was on her deathbed, and my poor grandmother, she couldn't hear very well, so I basically made amends to the whole family in that one, you know? But I mean, I can go and I can see my family, and I don't feel like I have to hide my face, or that, you know, they can't tell their little stories, and, you know, because some of them are tragically funny. I mean, my mom and I have really had some laughs later on about some of the stuff I pulled when I was younger, but I don't think that would have been possible without making those amends. And you know, my mom, you know, I grew up, I was daddy's little girl, you know, and I think I ignored my mother till I was probably about 19 years old, you know, and she was either in my way or yelling at me, or I felt like I just couldn't ever see myself having like a true relationship with her. And through like the steps and working with the sponsor, I not only have been able to see my mother as a person who, you know, is not just my mom. I mean, she has her own life, and she had her own dreams, and it just wasn't around me. And you know, we're really good friends. I mean, like, my mom is one of my best friends. And I talk to her almost every day. And although I don't feel like I've sat down with her and made direct amends, some of the conversations we've had, I mean, it, you know, we're right there, you know, because I felt really guilty that she was helping me get through school, because I felt like I still owe you so much money. And she's like, you know, she said if I knew that we went through all of that so you would be the person that you are today, I would do it again in a heartbeat. And that is just, trust me, that's a big, I don't know, I mean, it's like, I was just blown away. And so, I mean, I feel like my mom and I were not only, she's not just my mom, she's my friend, you know, and I never thought that was possible for me to have that kind of relationship with her, because I just, I saw all the things that, you know, I mean, I thought that the things that, you know, that I did not agree with from my childhood, that was all her fault. And, I mean, she did the best she could. I mean, I've really come to respect what, you know, how my parents tried to raise me. And I, you know, I've tried to put myself in their shoes, and it's like they did the best they could. And I hope I do the best I can when I have kids. So, kind of moving on to 10, 11, and 12 of the steps, I love the part in the big book where it talks about the four, you know, there's four things we have to do when we're, with taking a daily inventory. When we see something, we recognize it immediately, we talk to someone if needed, we ask God for forgiveness, and we ask who we can help, you know? And if I can remember to do that throughout my day, I mean, it's a good day, you know? I don't have any new problems in my life. You know, they're kind of the same ones recycled over and over again in different situations. I recently just started working for the, you know, having a real, I would call it a real job, but I work at a hospital, and I'm training to be in the OR, and I, you know, I love my job, and I can't stand my, you know, I'm one of those people that I feel like everything has to be perfect, and I'm supposed to know what I'm supposed to know before you can tell me what I'm supposed to know. And you know, that just makes for a really bad day at work. I mean, I just walk around sweating all the time because I can't do it right, you know, and obviously they don't expect me to do it right all the time, you know. But, you know, recently it's just been, when I'm in those situations and I can start to feel the, like, cold beads of sweat pop out and you know, with these surgeons, and they want what they want, like, 2 seconds ago, and you're not fast enough, and why haven't you done that? And I really had to turn to prayer. I mean, God, please help me get through this. Please give me the strength to get through this, because I just, you know, I don't like feeling uncomfortable, and I don't like feeling like I don't know what I'm doing. And that's been a big thing recently. And also, I just recently got engaged, and I'm living with somebody for the first time, and there's been a lot of to talk about with my sponsor, you know? I mean, and we're trying to grow together. I mean, we're doing the best we can, but, you know, I'm a very rigid, kind of uptight kind of girl, and I can make living difficult, you know? I have my ways of doing that, but, you know, I feel like we're, you know, if I'm looking at that, if I can't even see it, then I can't be willing to have God take it, you know? Because, I mean, I've tried many, I feel like the last 2 years of my sobriety has been about, you know, I'm going to have the self-control to do what I know I'm supposed to do and be, I don't want to say perfect, but just, you know, I'm going to stay in line, you know? And that just doesn't work for me. I mean, I can only stay in line for so long on my own power. And there has to be a power bigger than me that can not only take the obsession for alcohol away and the desire to drink, but they can also take the other defects that come along with it, you know? And I mean, I just want to say, I haven't thought about having a drink since my sobriety date. I mean, I was really, I mean, obviously it took 2 years to get to that point, but that surrender for me was the final surrender, you know. And there's been surrenders to more of my selfishness as I've gone along and to my, you know, false sense of pride. But it's really been an amazing journey. And I've had the privilege of working with other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And usually most of them don't stay with me, and that's okay, you know. Where I live, there's a lot of people with a lot of sobriety. But recently I've been able to work with one girl in particular, and she, you know, she's a real alcoholic, and we have a common problem, and we have a common solution, and it's really been a privilege to help someone and be a part of her life, and she just moved away. Her husband is in the military, and so she's down in North Carolina now. And I feel like even though she's down there, it's like we have a better, I mean, she calls every day, you know, and I try to remember to say a prayer before I answer the phone. And so I'm not just talking out of what I think I know or what I think I'm supposed to say, but to really be a channel for what is right for her, you know. And if I don't know, say I don't know, you know. So, and that's really strengthened my relationship with my sponsor, you know, because, I've definitely had, I mean, I've had, you know, bouts of self-will my whole, you know, I feel like to say that I'm not self-willed today would just be a lie, because I know somewhere it's there, you know. I might not be able to see it right now, but working with her has made it a lot easier, or not a lot easier, but I can see myself really clearly in her, and it helps me to talk to my sponsor about things that maybe I didn't think were objectionable, you know. So, and it's really been a privilege to, you know, go to detox. I have a detox commitment every week where I live, and I don't necessarily love the meeting. It's a psych ward meeting for adolescents, and it's not my favorite meeting of the week, but I'm there every week, you know, and I try to bring a message with people that I know that have that experience. And I think, you know, thank you so much for asking me to be here. It's been an honor, and I think I'm done.